The Grand Canyon isn't just a landscape. It's a 6,000-foot vertical cathedral of geological time, equivalent to 5 stacked Empire State Buildings. This immense chasm creates distinct ecological zones where temperatures rise 5F with every 1,000 feet of descent. Within its walls live 90 mammal species, 373 bird species, and rocks approaching 2 billion years old, nearly 40% of Earth's chronology etched in stone. For Kevin Ferdarko, the canyon represented everything his industrial Pennsylvania hometown lacked. Growing up in Pittsburgh, where businessmen changed blackened shirt collars twice daily and streetlights burned at noon due to pollution, the canyon's pristine wilderness called to him. His grandfather had spent 50 years in coal mines, starting at just 14, part of an industrial legacy that had severed people's connection to the land, most dramatically illustrated by the 1948 Donora death fog, when toxic emissions killed 20 people while the mills kept running. Among River Guide stories, one name appeared repeatedly, Kenton Grua. Short, wiry, and ferociously strong, Grua became obsessed with the canyon after his first teenage visit in 1962. In his hands, the dories responded like floating mandolins. Dissatisfied with claims of others walking the entire length of the canyon, Grua decided to tackle the journey himself in 1973. Unlike previous hikers, he chose Native American-style moccasins, the next best thing to going barefoot. His ultralight approach kept his pack under 30 pounds. Initially making excellent progress, his journey ended when cactus spines pierced his foot, causing an infection. In 1977, Grua tried again, this time wearing proper hiking boots. Moving at an astonishing pace of 15 to 30 miles daily, he completed the entire 600-mile journey in just 37 days, becoming the first person in modern times to walk the entire canyon. Unlike others who published best-selling books, Grua never sought publicity, sharing nothing from his 285-page journal, not even with his wife. At 38, Ferdarko became an unpaid river guide apprentice, facing numerous mishaps, but discovering the Colorado River Corridor's hidden treasures, from verdant oases to spectacular wildlife encounters. When photographer Pete McBride proposed documenting the Grand Canyon for the National Park Service's centennial, they partnered with Rich Rudo, a businessman and secret desert exploration legend. Rich designed a challenging 700-mile high route traversing slick rock thousands of feet above the river. The experience gap was evident from the start. While Rich's team packed efficiently, Pete and Kevin struggled with overweight packs. Their daily 4:30 a.m. starts turned into grueling 12-hour hikes, with failing equipment and Kevin's untreated blisters becoming severely infected, feeling like my feet were marinating in battery acid. Pete and Kevin returned to Flagstaff with severe injuries, Kevin's shredded feet and Pete's cactus-induced near-fatal seizure. When they doubted continuing, their doctor invoked Kenton Grua's eventual success after failure. That evening, outdoor professionals offered crucial guidance. They restructured their approach with ultralight backpacking experts, splitting the route into 5 segments instead of 3. Training shifted from strength building to efficiency and smart decision making. At the confluence where the Little Colorado meets the Colorado River, they camped under moonlight that silvered the merging waters, their intended destination from the start. At the rim, Navajo woman Renee Yellowhorse revealed this sacred birthplace was a tribal shrine where spirits returned. She described how in 2012, developers had planned Escalade, a resort complex with a tramway to bring thousands of daily visitors. "There's a myth that we left this landscape, but we never did," Yellowhorse explained, describing how this holy place held her ancestors' spirits and remained vital to Native people's lives. Beyond the Tonto Trail, the Great Thumb Mesa extends 20 miles from the South Rim. For 2 days, they crossed the frozen esplanade among cactus and dwarf pinyon, passing ancient storage overhangs, fire pits and agave roasting areas. Their journey faced crisis when their guide Amy's knee dislocated. Despite the risks, she refused helicopter rescue to preserve park resources. A winter storm then trapped them at the Thumb's exposed point with freezing rain and hail, transforming the esplanade into a snowy expanse. At dawn's 10-degree temperatures, Kevin thawed his frozen shoes over their camp stove. As the storm cleared, golden light illuminated distant canyon walls. The esplanade revealed wind-polished domes like turtlebacks and mushroom caps, while signs of ancient civilization, potsherds, arrowheads, and granary ruins dotted their path. Wild horses occasionally appeared, vanishing into distant arroyos. They discovered a narrow fissure leading to the river, and the next morning found a 15-foot-wide vertical crack with running water below. They prepared to rappel into the slot canyons, narrow passages often just 7 feet wide but hundreds of feet high, typically avoided due to flash flood risks. Rappelling 110 feet into Olo Slot Canyon, Kevin's fear transformed into awe. The slot widened like a wine bottle's neck, its trumpet-flared walls curving overhead. Though the sky disappeared, filtered sunlight created a luminous, reverent glow within. Following bighorn sheep trails downstream, they crossed the river with help from river runners and traversed tributary canyons beneath cottonwoods. After climbing into shaly dunes, Kevin unknowingly made camp among hundreds of prehistoric potsherds, ancient pottery fragments from a long-lost civilization. At 7:15 a.m., their peaceful riverside camp was disrupted by an endless stream of helicopters. Within hours, they had counted 65 aircraft, arriving roughly every 90 seconds. By day's end, after counting 250 helicopters, they abandoned the tally. Downstream, they found landing zones where tourists enjoyed champagne breaks between flights, a mechanized conveyor belt of tourism. This operation was part of the Hualapai tribe's economic strategy. After losing 80% of their ancestral lands, the tribe had turned to tourism. Their Grand Canyon West operation, featuring the glass-bottomed skywalk, now generated $165 million annually and attracted 1.1 million visitors. Rene Yellowhorse opposed similar development at Escalade. "We don't want to be the Disneyland on the edge of the Grand Canyon. That's not how we want our stories told." She challenged developers. "Why can't you listen when we say this is where we pray? Why can you not hear our voices, really hear them?" The morning after Helicopter Alley, they entered a tributary where mechanical noise gave way to nature's subtle sounds, falling pebbles and canyon wrens. This natural quiet felt like pure relief. Early light revealed the Grand Wash Cliffs, the canyon's end. The Sinuppe Plateau offered sweeping views to Zion's Cliffs, Nevada, and Arizona's Music Mountains. At night, an absolute silence descended, star-filled and pure. They absorbed every detail, from shadowed cacti to radiant sky. 10 days later, Kevin and Aaron returned for the final stretch, sharing meaningful conversations about their Pennsylvania roots and later moves to Maine and the Southwest. Watching visitors at the rim, Kevin realized that hiking 800 miles wasn't necessary to experience the canyon's essence. These tourists were fellow pilgrims, each finding their own connection to this sacred place.